How many folks just wonder what's happening to this world and we surely must be on the brink of destruction? About 50 years ago, when I was a teenager, Barry McGuire recorded a popular song entitled "The Eve of Destruction." Everything is just falling apart. It's just terrible. Movies and books about the end times are very popular today, and that's not anything new. In 1938, there was panic in the streets over a radio broadcast over a story about an invasion from Mars. And quite an interesting story about how that took place. A fellow is just reading a story and people take it as the news and real and just panic in the streets. In this last century, how many individuals or groups have declared a specific day that the world would come to an end? And how many have come true? None, because here we are. It's still here. Often we look at these young children and young folks, and June happens to be a time of change in a lot of people's lives. A lot of times there's weddings, perhaps births, graduations, people taking a new change in their life, things that are going through, and often as parents and grandparents we wonder, what's it going to be like for our children? Or our grandchildren. What's this world hold for them? Well, tonight, I would like for us to notice that it's not the end of the world. Steve read for us from Ecclesiastes. I'd like to go back and look at that. The wisest, most insightful man gives us some insight on this thought. He says a generation comes and a generation goes, but the sun still rises, the moon sets. The winds circle about, there's weather, there's change in seasons. The rivers continue to flow. The oceans don't fill up. I don't think there's ever been an alert in New Orleans or northern Egypt that, oh no, the Mississippi is dried up. What happened? The Nile is dried. Quit running. You know, what's happened? You know, they continue to flow. The seas don't fill up. It's like they don't shut down the deltas saying, well, the sea is full, so we can't take any more. God's cycle just continues. And he shows us that in the things around us. He says, the eye's not satisfied with seeing nor the ear filled with hearing. Why is it that people will trade in a perfectly good one of these, or a car, or a television, for a new one? Because it's new. Because there's something else about it that's different, and so I want one of those. We're never satisfied with what we have now, and we always want to change. Solomon tells us that, and is that not true? Things that we have now, we can look back and say, oh, I remember something very similar. And things right now that we seem to be very new, people in the future will look back and say, oh, that, you know, I don't even remember that, you know. It's a cyclical thing, and we get worried about things happening and thinking, all is coming apart. I really appreciated the songs that Jeff led today. He asked me what I was speaking about, and I gave him sort of an idea and gave him the passage in Ecclesiastes, and the songs he selected just really went well with the fact that we follow God and he's dependable, he's solid, his creation is there, and I can depend on him no matter what else is happening around me. I can depend on that. Solomon here is speaking about the overimportance of our everyday lives. And you read through the book of Ecclesiastes and Solomon talks about all the things that he did, and it's just vanity, it's folly, why do that? And if all you're thinking about is right now, that's true. But when you put God in the equation, when you put God in the picture, it makes sense and there's understanding to that. In the early 1900s, there was an individual, Jorge Santayana, who actually was an American citizen born in Chicago, but had a Spanish father, and so the reason for the name. He coined the phrase, which has been changed a lot but very familiar, that says that those who do not learn from the past are condemned to repeat it. And so you want to figure out what to do in the future, look at the past and see what history has to show for us and learn from those mistakes. You think about all of the things that are just seem to be rampant in our world and things that are out of control. I want to look at these particular things from a historical standpoint and see kind of where they've been and where we are today with some of these. This quote about children says, "The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders. They love to chatter in place of exercise. They are the tyrants in the homes, not helping. They no longer rise when elders enter the room, and they contradict their parents." Sound familiar? Probably could have been written when I was a teenager. Or any generation before that. You think back, I think back when I was a teenager in the turbulent 60s and all the things were happening and going on and stuff, and like, what does this world come to? Where are these kids gonna, where are they gonna take us? What's gonna happen when they grow up and they're the world leaders, and probably parents in the 40s and 30s and 20s and on back down, all wonder the same thing. What's gonna happen to the next generation? Well, that was written in 425. Things haven't really changed a whole lot. Think about Jacob's boys. If you were the youngest, or if you were the youngest child, and especially by a few years maybe in your family, did your older siblings ever talk you into doing something, or maybe just force you into doing something that was a little bit dangerous, like maybe jumping off the roof onto a mattress to see how far you could fly? Siblings do that with one another. Jacob's boys sold their brother. Sold him. And then lied to their father about what happened to him. There were probably times when I would like to have sold my brother, but I never really went through with that. But We look at children and we think, oh man, what's going on with this generation? And they've not changed. For centuries, children do these things. And the sad thing is, we look at those who make the news. Of all those out there that are causing problems, there's kids like these and back there and scattered through here that are doing the right things. And they don't get a lot of attention. But they're the solid ones. And they'll be here, and the next generation will produce children like that, and on and on. Think about the immorality in this world and the constant barrage in the news about the acceptance of sin. Homosexuality, fornication, the celebration of childbirth outside of marriage. That seems to be something that young people celebrate. Oh, we're having a baby, and they've forgotten about how God's plan was for that to work. And it's out there, and you just need to tolerate that and accept that. We looked this morning, when we were studying in the lesson this morning about the church in Corinth, boasted itself on being tolerant about sin in its midst. And Paul says, you're boasting about things that are evil. We are barraged with the ideas of homosexuality and sexual sins that are out there. But it's not new. Think about what Lot faced in Sodom and Gomorrah. We think about cities that are spots of homosexuality. maybe Key West or San Francisco or Bloomington, Indiana. Kathy and I have been to all three of those cities, visited those at different times, and I've never had anyone from one of those cities come up and ask, let alone force me into a sexual situation that was a perversion of what God's teaching was. Yet that's what was happening in Lot's city. And so we sometimes worry about all of this, and it's been there. The early Christians faced such in a Roman and Greek culture. Prostitution was part of their daily worship. That's just what they did. Homosexuality was just the norm in especially the Roman political scene. That's what it was. If you weren't involved in that, you were the oddball. Well, does that sound familiar at times? It's not changed. What about marriage? You've heard the saying that as a family goes, so goes the nation. Divorce is rampant. If you listen to the news or whatever, that's just, you know, how many people have been divorced multiple times. And the world is just filled with that. 2,400 years ago, there was a problem with divorce among God's people because he sent Malachi to remind them that he hated it. When God sends somebody specifically to tell his people, I hate divorce. You need to stop this. And we think about it today, God still hates it, but it's still here. We look at well-known political figures today and in our recent past, and their commitment to marriage fidelity is no different than David and Solomon. These were leaders of God's people, and they had a problem with fidelity within their marriage. The natural desire that God has placed in men and women of the sexual relationship has not changed since Adam and Eve, and there are those who will always abuse it, always have. What about poverty? Kathy and I over the weekend were out on pulling off the interstate on a road that really has nothing around it. It's just an exit off the interstate. And there's a guy standing there with the sign, "We'll work for food." It's not like in certainly, it's everywhere. There's poverty everywhere for a multitude of reasons. Why people are poor varies with the individual and with the circumstances. But in Mark 14 and 7, Judas complains about a woman who would anoint Jesus with a precious ointment, saying that they should have sold that ointment to help the poor, and he just wanted to pocket the money. He was a thief, Luke would tell us. But Jesus said, you'll always have the poor. They will always be here. There will always be economic disparity in this world because you all are human. And we'll look at that here in the next point a little bit. It will always be there. What about war? Anyone remember what the slogan was following World War I? The war to end all wars. Guess what? Had several since. Less than 20 years after, there was World War II. And who knows how many wars there were in between that nobody really knew about because it didn't affect the world economically. So nobody knew, nobody cared. There's people fighting each other all of the time. I don't know how many people are concerned daily with the trouble in the Middle East. They've been fighting in the Middle East since there was a Middle East. The Jewish nation has been at odds with almost everyone since they left Egypt. Read Judges and Kings. There's somebody always wanting to pick a fight with them. And part of it is because God gave them a land that had belonged to someone else. And those other folks still think they own that land, and they're still fighting over that. And they will till this world ends, I imagine, we'll fight and devour one another because of that. Religious wars, the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition, things that were fought because supposedly of religion. In the name of religion, we're doing this. Conflicts pretty much boil down to this: power and economics. That's basically what it's about. Whether it was the Civil War and dealing with slavery or whatever else, doing with economics that was hampering the southern owners of plantations, or today fighting over some oil. You know, it's economic and power struggles that causes conflicts. Will that ever change? Probably not. It's been here forever. People fought over having a piece of property and will go to war over that. We'll kill for that. When Scott Hafer was here, we were talking, and he's mentioned, and I've seen these signs before where someone out somewhere out in the country somewhere will have a sign on their driveway coming up into the yard, and it says, with a picture of a gun on it, and says, "There's nothing here worth dying for." Scott said, "I'd like to put one up that says, 'There's nothing here worth killing for.'" You know, what would I kill somebody over? You know, especially something, a piece of property, you know. That's our mindset of people. But let's turn around a little bit. Let's look at some heroes and some things that show that God is still in control. And when we sometimes kind of lose hope and wonder what's going on, God created Adam and Eve, and sadly they introduced sin to the world. And it finally got so bad that there was one family left. A man and his wife and his three boys and their wives. Noah. I don't know what the world population was in Noah's day, but it had to be huge, and there's one family. And God says, "I'm going to destroy this and start all over, because I've got one family that can do that." It's not a very big remnant, but it was a remnant. And he started over. Later he would take Abraham and say, "Abraham, from you I'm going to make a great nation." And he did. And there were issues with that nation. And some 430 years later, they are like, they've been in slavery for years. They're in Egypt. They have no leadership. They have nothing. They wonder where God is. What has happened to us? And God says, "I'm going to rescue you." And he sent Moses. And they started over. There are heroes that God knows about and uses. David would rise up from a shepherd boy and bring the nation of Israel together to begin a tremendous reign of power and glory for that nation, only to have his grandchildren, grandson, throw it all away. And they would go right back into slavery, into captivity again. But then he'd find a Daniel or a Mordecai or an Esther that would stand up and help define that nation. In the New Testament, Jesus, this renegade preacher who is stirring up so much trouble, is finally killed, and so everything is, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Well, then you've got Peter and John and Paul. Men who stand up and live their lives at the forefront of that battle. But then in the background, you've got people like Barnabas and Aquila and Priscilla and an unnamed Ethiopian. And besides them, there are hundreds, thousands of disciples of Jesus that were there and continued to serve. And they were strong. There have always been remnants through the ages. Sometimes we just don't know they're there. How many Christians are there today, truly Bible-believing Christians in this world compared to the rest of the populations. Probably a really small comparison, but we're here. You're here tonight. You were here this morning. You'll be back Wednesday. Some of you Wednesday morning and Wednesday night. And you'll go home tomorrow or tonight and you'll live your lives serving God, unaware of what the next day may bring, but knowing that He's there. Matthew 16 and 18, I made a reference to this morning. Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it. And He did. And it's still here. And it's not going to go away. It may get a little bit lost in the world sometimes, but it's here. Jesus died for it and He said, it will remain here. There will be people who will follow Me. He knew that. He knew there would be people that would mock Him and wouldn't care, but He knew there would be people that would follow Him. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, as Paul finishes that letter of instruction and sometimes some discipline, he says, therefore, brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain. Everything that you're doing, serving God, He knows about, and He will reward you for that. We just talked about all the issues that's going on in this world with all the bad things that are happening. And we're trying here to develop a deeper faith and holier lives and stronger families so that we produce a remnant. Someone did that for us, and we need to do that. We need to carry that on and keep that going on. We need to develop the leadership in this congregation and see that that continues, that we don't drop the ball here. He says, your labor is not in vain. I'd like to read from Romans chapter 8. I'm going to begin in verse 28 and then jump down to verse 31. Paul, writing to these Christians in Rome, says in Romans 8, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. There were difficult times in Rome. Paul says, but God causes these things to work together for good. In verse 31, beginning, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who's against us? He who did not spare His own Son, but delivered Him over for us all, how will He not also with Him freely give us all things? Who will bring a charge against God's elect? God's the one who justifies. Who is the one who condemns? Jesus Christ is He who died, yes, rather was raised, and who is at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? They had the same problems then that we've got today, probably worse. And He says, who's going to keep you from the love of Christ? In verse 37, He says, but in all these things, we overwhelmingly conquer through Him who loved us. I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, or any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. He's there, and He's not going anywhere, and He loves us, and He knows what's going on here. And He knew what was going on in Babylon when Daniel was there. And He knew what was going on in Persia when Mordecai and Esther were there. He knew what was going on in Egypt when His children were in slavery. He knows what's happening in the United States today. And He knows where we're at. Do we know where we're at? 2 Corinthians 4, I've used this passage before. And kind of like the idea here, beginning in verse 7 through verse 10, Paul talks about the fact that, has been talking about the fact that he and these other Christians, by the grace of God, were given the task of carrying the gospel to the world. You and I included in that. In verse 7, he says, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power of God will be of God and not from ourselves. He wants them to see that this gospel, this power, is not from us. We just are carriers. It's from God. That's where it's from. He says, but we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our body. I think of the old, usually they were a clown punching bag or somebody, you know, with sand in the bottom or some kind of a weight, and you knock them down, they get right back up. That's what I look at here when I think about Paul describing that, you know. It doesn't matter how many times you knock me down, I'm getting back up. I'm not staying down. And that's what Paul is saying. Every day we are afflicted in some way, but we're not crushed. We get confused, but we're not despairing. You know, we're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. God knows. We're struck down, but we're not destroyed. I was trying to pick a passage or two out of Revelation, and I just couldn't find one to finish up the lesson today. So Revelation is about victory in Jesus. We win. All that's going on around us, we're going to win. It's a good thing. I asked Jeff to lead this last song called There's a Great Day Coming, because one day this world will come to an end completely, and it will be a great day. And Jesus said that it would be like in the days of Noah. No one would be expecting it. It would just happen. It would just come. And so it will be when Jesus returns, just another day. But if Jesus comes before we die, what a glorious reunion for his family. Arnie was telling me that he went to visit Jim yesterday, and he probably knew he wouldn't be back to see him today. And as he got ready to leave yesterday, he told Jim, he said, well, I'll see you Monday. And I think he kind of paused there, and Jim said, unless I die, and I'll see you in heaven. He knew that life here isn't going to last, and we know that. We don't know when it will come to an end, but are we ready for that great day? This song describes the fact there's a great day, and some will be ready and some won't. And you know whether you're ready right now or not. You know, are you where you need to be? As we talked this morning, do you have loved ones and family and friends that if that day comes tonight will not be a good day for them? We need to never lose sight of the fact that there's a great day that's coming, and we need to be ready for that. And of everything going on around us that has just looked like it's upside down, remember that God's there and that we will win if we stay strong, and he's promised to look out for us and take care of us. We may not figure out how that's going to work to our benefit or to his. I'm sure Paul certainly wondered when he was taken to Rome under custody about how this is going to work out, but he trusted God that it would work out for the good. And it did. He wrote several letters while he was in prison that we get to share. Are you ready for that day to come? If you're not, maybe you need to make some changes, and tonight would be a good time to do that.